This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Romancing Mr. Bridgerton by Julia Quinn. Narrated by Rosalind Landor. April is nearly upon us, and with it a new social season here in London. Ambitious mamas can be found at dress shops all across town with their darling debutantes, eager to purchase that one magical evening gown that they simply know will mean the difference between marriage and spinsterhood. As for their prey, the determined bachelors, Mr. Colin Bridgerton once again tops the list of desirable husbands, even though he is not yet back from his recent trip abroad. He has no title, that is true, but he is in abundant possession of looks, fortune, and, as anyone who has ever spent even a minute in London knows, charm. But Mr. Bridgerton has reached the somewhat advanced age of 33, without ever showing an interest in any particular young lady, and there is little reason to anticipate that 1824 will be any different from 1823 in this respect. Perhaps the darling debutantes, and perhaps more importantly their ambitious mamas, would do well to look elsewhere. If Mr. Bridgerton is looking for a wife, he hides that desire well. On the other hand, is that not just the sort of challenge a debutante likes best? Lady Whistledown's Society Papers. Prologue. On the 6th of April, in the year 1812, precisely 2 days before her 16th birthday, Penelope Featherington fell in love. It was, in a word, thrilling. The world shook. Her heart leaped. The moment was breathtaking. And, she was able to tell herself with some satisfaction, the man in question, one Colin Bridgerton, felt precisely the same way. Oh, not the love part. He certainly didn't fall in love with her in 1812, and not in 1813, 1814, 1815, or, oh blast, not in all the years 1816 to 1822 either, and certainly not in 1823, when he was out of the country the whole time anyway. But his earth shook, his heart leaped, and Penelope knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that his breath was taken away as well. For a good 10 seconds. Falling off a horse tended to do that to a man. It happened thus. She'd been out for a walk in Hyde Park with her mother and 2 older sisters when she felt a thunderous rumbling under her feet. Listen again to the bit about the earth shaking. Her mother wasn't paying much attention to her. Her mother rarely did. So Penelope slipped away for a moment to see what was about. The rest of the Featheringtons were in rapt conversation with Viscountess Bridgerton and her daughter Daphne, who had just begun her 2nd season in London, so they were pretending to ignore the rumbling. The Bridgertons were an important family indeed, and conversations with them were not to be ignored. As Penelope skirted around the edge of a particularly fat-trunked tree, she saw 2 riders coming her way, galloping along hell for leather, or whatever expression people liked to use for fools on horseback who care not for their safety and well-being. Penelope felt her heart quicken. It would have been difficult to maintain a sedate pulse as a witness to such excitement, and besides, this allowed her to say that her heart leaped when she fell in love. Then, in one of those inexplicable quirks of fate, the wind picked up quite suddenly and lifted her bonnet, which, much to her mother's chagrin, she had not tied properly since the ribbon chafed under her chin, straight into the air and splat, right onto the face of one of the riders. Penelope gasped, taking her breath away, and then the man fell off his horse, landing most inelegantly in a nearby mud puddle. She rushed forward, quite without thinking, squealing something that was meant to inquire after his welfare, but that she suspected came out as nothing more than a strangled shriek. He would, of course, be furious with her, since she'd effectively knocked him off his horse and covered him with mud, 2 things guaranteed to put any gentleman in the foulest of moods. but when he finally rose to his feet, brushing off whatever mud could be dislodged from his clothing, he didn't lash out at her. He didn't give her a stinging set-down. He didn't yell. He didn't even glare. He laughed. He laughed. Penelope hadn't much experience with the laughter of men, and what little she had known had not been kind. But this man's eyes, a rather intense shade of green, were filled with mirth as he wiped a rather embarrassingly placed spot of mud off his cheek and said, "Well, that wasn't very well done of me, was it?" And in that moment, Penelope fell in love. When she found her voice, which she was pained to note was a good 3 seconds after a person of any intelligence would have replied, she said,
"Oh, no, it is I who should apologise. My bonnet came right off my head and..."
She stopped talking when she realised he hadn't actually apologised, so there was little point in contradicting him.
"It was no trouble,"
he said, giving her a somewhat amused smile.
"I... Oh, good day, Daphne. Didn't know you were in the park."
Penelope whirled around to find herself facing Daphne Bridgerton, standing next to her mother, who promptly hissed,
"What have you done, Penelope Featherington?"
And Penelope couldn't even answer with her stock, "Nothing." Because, in truth, the accident was completely her fault, and she'd just made a fool of herself in front of what was obviously, judging from the expression on her mother's face, a very eligible bachelor indeed. Not that her mother would have thought that she had a chance with him, but Mrs. Featherington held high matrimonial hopes for her older girls. Besides, Penelope wasn't even out in society yet. But if Mrs. Featherington intended to scold her any further, she was unable to do so, because that would have required that she remove her attention from the all-important Bridgertons, whose ranks, Penelope was quickly figuring out, included the man presently covered in mud.
"I hope your son isn't injured,"
Mrs. Featherington said to Lady Bridgerton.
"Right as rain,"
Colin interjected, making an expert sidestep before Lady Bridgerton could maul him with motherly concern. Introductions were made, but the rest of the conversation was unimportant, mostly because Colin quickly and accurately sized up Mrs. Featherington as a matchmaking mamma. Penelope was not at all surprised when he beat a hasty retreat. But the damage had already been done. Penelope had discovered a reason to dream. Later that night, as she replayed the encounter for about the 1,000th time in her mind, it occurred to her that it would have been nice if she could have said that she'd fallen in love with him as he kissed her hand before a dance, his green eyes twinkling devilishly while his fingers held hers just a little more tightly than was proper. Or maybe it could have happened as he rode boldly across a windswept moor, the aforementioned wind no deterrent, as he, or rather his horse, galloped ever closer, his, Colin's not the horse's, only intention to reach her side. But no, she had to go and fall in love with Colin Bridgerton when he fell off a horse and landed on his bottom in a mud puddle. It was highly irregular and highly unromantic, but there was a certain poetic justice in that, since nothing was ever going to come of it. Why waste romance on a love that would never be returned? Better to save the windswept moor introductions for people who might actually have a future together. And if there was one thing Penelope knew, even then, at the age of 16 years minus 2 days, it was that her future did not feature Colin Bridgerton in the role of husband. She simply wasn't the sort of girl who attracted a man like him, and she feared that she never would be. On the 10th of April, in the year 1813, precisely 2 days after her 17th birthday, Penelope Featherington made her debut into London society. She hadn't wanted to do it. She begged her mother to let her wait a year. She was at least 2 stone heavier than she ought to be, and her face still had an awful tendency to develop spots whenever she was nervous, which meant that she always had spots, since nothing in the world could make her as nervous as a London ball. She tried to remind herself that beauty was only skin deep, but that didn't offer any helpful excuses when she was berating herself for never knowing what to say to people. There was nothing more depressing than an ugly girl with no personality. And in that first year on the marriage mart, that was exactly what Penelope was. An ugly girl with no... Oh, very well, she had to give herself some credit. With very little personality. Deep inside, she knew who she was, and that person was smart and kind and often even funny. But somehow her personality always got lost somewhere between her heart and her mouth, and she found herself saying the wrong thing, or, more often, nothing at all. To make matters even less attractive, Penelope's mother refused to allow Penelope to choose her own clothing, and when she wasn't in the requisite white that most young ladies wore, and which, of course, didn't flatter her complexion one bit, she was forced to wear yellow and red and orange, all of which made her look perfectly wretched. The one time Penelope had suggested green, Mrs. Featherington had planted her hands on her more than ample hips and declared that green was too melancholy. Yellow, Mrs. Featherington declared, was a happy colour, and a happy girl would snare a husband. Penelope decided then and there that it was best not to try to understand the workings of her mother's mind. So Penelope found herself outfitted in yellow and orange and the occasional red, even though such colours made her look decidedly unhappy, and in fact were positively ghastly with her brown eyes and red-tinged hair. There was nothing she could do about it, though, so she decided to grin and bear it, and if she couldn't manage a grin, at least she wouldn't cry in public, which, she took some pride in noting, she never did. And if that weren't enough, 1813 was the year that the mysterious and fictitious Lady Whistledown began publishing her thrice-weekly society papers. The single-sheet newspaper became an instant sensation. No one knew who Lady Whistledown really was, but everyone seemed to have a theory. For weeks, no, months really, London could speak of nothing else. The paper had been delivered for free for 2 weeks, just long enough to addict the ton, and then suddenly there was no delivery, just paper boys charging the outrageous price of 5 pennies a paper. But by then, no one could live without the almost daily dose of gossip, and everyone paid their pennies. Somewhere, some woman, or maybe, some people speculated, some man, was growing very rich indeed. What set Lady Whistledown's society papers apart from any previous society news sheets was that the author actually listed her subjects' names in full. There was no hiding behind abbreviations such as Lord P or Lady B. If Lady Whistledown wanted to write about someone, she used his full name. And when Lady Whistledown wanted to write about Penelope Featherington, she did. Penelope's first appearance in Lady Whistledown's society papers went as follows. Miss Penelope Featherington's unfortunate gown left the unfortunate girl looking like nothing more than an overripe citrus fruit. A rather stinging blow, to be sure, but nothing less than the truth. Her second appearance in the column was no better. Not a word was heard from Miss Penelope Featherington, and no wonder. The poor girl appeared to have drowned amidst the ruffles of her dress. Not, Penelope was afraid, anything that would enhance her popularity. But the season wasn't a complete disaster. There were a few people with whom she seemed able to speak. Lady Bridgerton, of all people, took a liking to her, and Penelope found that she could often tell things to the lovely Viscountess that she would never dream of saying to her own mother. It was through Lady Bridgerton that she met Eloise Bridgerton, the younger sister of her beloved Colin. Eloise was also just turned 17, but her mother had wisely allowed her to delay her debut by a year, even though Eloise possessed the Bridgerton good looks and charm in abundance. And while Penelope spent her afternoons in the green and cream drawing room at Bridgerton House, or more often up in Eloise's bedchamber, where the two girls laughed and giggled and discussed everything under the sun with great earnestness, she found herself coming into occasional contact with Colin, who, at 22, had not yet moved out of the family home and into bachelor lodgings. If Penelope had thought she loved him before, that was nothing compared to what she felt after actually getting to know him. Colin Bridgerton was witty. He was dashing. He had a devil-may-care jokester quality to him that made women swoon. But most of all, Colin Bridgerton was nice. Nice. Such a silly little word. It should have been banal, but somehow it fit him to perfection. He always had something nice to say to Penelope, and when she finally worked up the courage to say something back, other than the very basic greetings and farewells, he actually listened, which made it all the easier the next time around. By the end of the season, Penelope judged that Colin Bridgerton was the only man with whom she'd managed an entire conversation. This was love. Oh, this was love, 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 love. A silly repetition of words, perhaps, but that was precisely what Penelope doodled on a ridiculously expensive sheet of writing paper, along with the words, Mrs. Colin Bridgerton, and Penelope Bridgerton, and Colin, Colin, Colin. The paper went into the fire the moment Penelope heard footsteps in the hall. How wonderful it was to feel love, even the one-sided sort, for a nice person. It made one feel so positively sensible. Of course, it didn't hurt that Colin possessed, as did all the Bridgerton men, fabulous good looks. There was that famous Bridgerton chestnut hair, the wide and smiling Bridgerton mouth, the broad shoulders, the 6-foot height, and in Colin's case, the most devastating green eyes ever to grace a human face. They were the sort of eyes that haunted a girl's dreams, and Penelope dreamed and dreamed and dreamed. April of 1814 found Penelope back in London for a second season, and even though she attracted the same number of suitors as the year before, 0, the season wasn't, in all honesty, quite so bad. It helped that she'd lost nearly 2 stone and could now call herself pleasantly rounded rather than a hideous pudge. She was still nowhere near the slender ideal of womanhood that ruled the day, but at least she'd changed enough to warrant the purchase of a completely new wardrobe. Unfortunately, her mother once again insisted on yellow, orange, and the occasional splash of red. And this time, Lady Whistledown wrote, Miss Penelope Featherington, the least inane of the Featherington sisters, wore a gown of lemon yellow that left a sour taste in one's mouth, which at least seemed to imply that Penelope was the most intelligent member of her family, although the compliment was backhanded indeed. But Penelope wasn't the only one singled out by the acerbic gossip columnist. Dark-haired Kate Sheffield was likened to a singed daffodil in her yellow dress, and Kate went on to marry Anthony Bridgerton, Colin's older brother, and a viscount to boot. So Penelope held out hope. Well, not really. She knew Colin wasn't going to marry her, but at least he danced with her at every ball, and he made her laugh, and every now and then she made him laugh, and she knew that that would have to be enough. And so Penelope's life continued. She had her 3rd season, then her 4th. Her 2 older sisters, Prudence and Philippa, finally found husbands of their own and moved away. Mrs. Featherington held out hope that Penelope might still make a match, since it had taken both Prudence and Philippa 5 seasons to snare husbands. But Penelope knew that she was destined to remain a spinster. It wouldn't be fair to marry someone when she was still so desperately in love with Colin. And maybe, in the far reaches of her mind, in the farthest back corner, tucked away behind the French verb conjugations she'd never mastered and the arithmetic she never used, she still held out a tiny shred of hope. Until that day. Even now, 7 years later, she still referred to it as that day. She'd gone to the Bridgerton household, as she frequently did, to take tea with Eloise and her mother and sisters. It was right before Eloise's brother Benedict had married Sophie, only he didn't know who she really was, and, well, that didn't signify, except that it may have been the one truly great secret in the last decade that Lady Whistledown had never managed to unearth. Anyway, she was walking through the front hall, listening to her feet tap along the marble tile as she saw herself out. She was adjusting her pelisse and preparing to walk the short distance to her own home, just around the corner, really, when she heard voices. Male voices. Male Bridgerton voices. It was the 3 elder Bridgerton brothers, Anthony, Benedict, and Colin. They were having one of those conversations that men have, the kind in which they grumble a lot and poke fun at each other. Penelope had always liked to watch the Bridgertons interact in this manner. They were such a family. Penelope could see them through the open front door, but she couldn't hear what they were saying until she'd reached the threshold. And in a testament to the bad timing that had plagued her throughout her life, the first voice she heard was Colin's, and the words were not kind. "And I am certainly not going to marry Penelope Featherington!"
"Oh!"
The word slipped over her lips before she could even think, the squeal of it piercing the air like an off-key whistle. The 3 Bridgerton men turned to face her with identical, horrified faces, and Penelope knew that she had just entered into what would certainly be the most awful 5 minutes of her life. She said nothing for what seemed like an eternity, and then, finally, with the dignity she never dreamed she possessed, she looked straight at Colin and said,
"I never asked you to marry me."
His cheeks went from pink to red. He opened his mouth, but not a sound came out. It was, Penelope thought with wry satisfaction, probably the only time in his life he'd ever been at a loss for words.
"And I never," she swallowed convulsively, "I never said to anyone that I wanted you to ask me."
"Penelope," Colin finally managed, "I'm so sorry."
"You have nothing to apologise for," she said.
"No," he insisted, "I do. I hurt your feelings and..."
"You didn't know I was there."
"But nevertheless..."
"You're not going to marry me," she said,
her voice sounding very strange and hollow to her ears.
"There is nothing wrong with that. I'm not going to marry your brother Benedict."
Benedict had clearly been trying not to look, but he snapped to attention at that. Penelope fisted her hands at her sides.
"It doesn't hurt his feelings when I announce that I'm not going to marry him."
She turned to Benedict, forcing her eyes directly on his.
"Does it, Mr. Bridgerton?"
"Of course not,"
Benedict answered quickly.
"It's settled, then,"
she said tightly, amazed that, for once, exactly the right words were coming out of her mouth.
"No feelings were hurt. Now then, if you will excuse me, gentlemen, I should like to go home."
The 3 gentlemen immediately stood back to let her pass, and she would have made a clean escape, except that Colin suddenly blurted out,
"Don't you have a maid?"
She shook her head.
"I live just around the corner."
"I know, but I'll escort you," Anthony said smoothly.
"That's really not necessary, my lord."
"Humour me," he said,
in a tone that told her quite clearly she hadn't any choice in the matter. She nodded, and the two of them took off down the street. After they had passed about 3 houses, Anthony said in a strangely respectful voice, "He didn't know you were there." Penelope felt her lips tighten at the corners, not out of anger, just out of a weary sense of resignation.
"I know," she replied. "He's not the sort to be cruel. I expect your mother has been hounding him to get married."
Anthony nodded. Lady Bridgerton's intentions to see each and every one of her 8 offspring happily married were legendary.
"She likes me," Penelope said. "Your mother, that is. She can't see beyond that, I'm afraid. But the truth is, it doesn't matter so much if she likes Colin's bride."
"Well, I wouldn't say that,"
Anthony mused, sounding not so much like a highly feared and respected viscount, and rather more like a well-behaved son.
"I shouldn't like to be married to someone my mother didn't like."
He shook his head in a gesture of great awe and respect.
"She's a force of nature."
"Your mother or your wife?"
He considered that for about half a second.
"Both."
They walked for a few moments, and then Penelope blurted out,
"Colin should go away."
Anthony eyed her curiously.
"I beg your pardon?"
"He should go away. Travel. He's not ready to marry, and your mother won't be able to restrain herself from pressuring him. She means well."
Penelope bit her lip in horror. She hoped the Viscount didn't think she was actually criticising Lady Bridgerton. As far as she was concerned, there was no greater lady in England.
"My mother always means well," Anthony said with an indulgent smile. "But maybe you're right. Perhaps he should get away. Colin does enjoy travel, although he did just return from Wales."
"Did he?"
Penelope murmured politely, as if she didn't know perfectly well that he'd been in Wales.
"Here we are,"
he said, as he nodded his reply.
"This is your house, is it not?"
"Yes. Thank you for accompanying me home."
"It was my pleasure, I assure you."
Penelope watched as he left. Then she went inside and cried. The very next day, the following account appeared in Lady Whistledown's society papers. "La, but such excitement yesterday on the front steps of Lady Bridgerton's residence on Bruton Street. First, Penelope Featherington was seen in the company of not one, not two, but 3 Bridgerton brothers. Surely a heretofore impossible feat for the poor girl, who is rather infamous for her wallflower ways. Sadly, but perhaps predictably for Miss Featherington, when she finally departed, it was on the arm of the Viscount, the only married man in the bunch. If Miss Featherington were to somehow manage to drag a Bridgerton brother to the altar, it would surely mean the end of the world as we know it. And this author, who freely admits she would not know heads from tails in such a world, would be forced to resign her post on the spot." It seemed even Lady Whistledown understood the futility of Penelope's feelings for Colin. The years drifted by, and somehow, without realising it, Penelope ceased to be a debutante and found herself sitting with the chaperones, watching her younger sister Felicity, surely the only Featherington sister blessed with both natural beauty and charm, enjoying her own London seasons. Colin developed a taste for travel, and began to spend more and more time outside of London. It seemed that every few months he was off to some new destination. When he was in town, he always saved a dance and a smile for Penelope, and somehow she managed to pretend that nothing had ever happened, that he'd never declared his distaste for her on a public street, that her dreams had never been shattered. And when he was in town, which wasn't often, they seemed to settle into an easy, if not terribly, deep friendship, which was all an almost 28-year-old spinster could hope for, right? unrequited love was never easy, but at least Penelope Featherington was used to it. Chapter 1
Matchmaking mamas are united in their glee. Colin Bridgerton has returned from Greece. For those gentle and ignorant readers who are new to town this year, Mr. Bridgerton is third in the legendary string of 8 Bridgerton siblings, hence the name Colin, beginning with C. He follows Antony and Benedict, and precedes Daphne, Eloise, Francesca, Gregory, and Hyacinth. Although Mr. Bridgerton holds no noble title, and is unlikely ever to do so, he is 7th in line for the title of Viscount Bridgerton, behind the 2 sons of the current Viscount, his elder brother Benedict, and his 3 sons, he is still considered one of the prime catches of the season, due to his fortune, his face, his form, and most of all, his charm. It is difficult, however, to predict whether Mr. Bridgerton will succumb to matrimonial bliss this season. He is certainly of an age to marry, 33, but he has never shown a decided interest in any lady of proper parentage. And to make matters even more complicated, he has an appalling tendency to leave London at the drop of a hat, bound for some exotic destination. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 2nd of April, 1824.
"Look at this!" Portia Featherington squealed. "Colin Bridgerton is back!"
Penelope looked up from her needlework. Her mother was clutching the latest edition of Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, the way Penelope might clutch, say, a rope while hanging off a building.
"I know," she murmured.
Portia frowned. She hated when someone, anyone, was aware of gossip before she was.
"How did you get to Whistledown before I did? I told Brierly to set it aside for me and not to let anyone touch."
"I didn't see it in Whistledown," Penelope interrupted, before her mother went off to castigate the poor, beleaguered butler. "Felicity told me. Yesterday afternoon, Hyacinth Bridgerton told her."
"Your sister spends a great deal of time over at the Bridgerton household."
"As do I,"
Penelope pointed out, wondering where this was leading. Portia tapped her finger against the side of her chin, as she always did when she was plotting or scheming.
"Colin Bridgerton is of an age to be looking for a wife."
Penelope managed to blink just before her eyes bugged right out of her head.
"Colin Bridgerton is not going to marry Felicity."
Portia gave a little shrug.
"Stranger things have happened."
"Not that I've ever seen," Penelope muttered.
"Antony Bridgerton married that Kate Sheffield girl, and she was even less popular than you."
That wasn't exactly true. Penelope rather thought they'd been on equally low rungs of the social ladder, but there seemed little point in telling this to her mother, who probably thought she'd complimented her third daughter by saying she'd not been the least popular girl that season. Penelope felt her lips tightening. Her mother's compliments had a habit of landing rather like wasps.
"Do not think I mean to criticise," Portia said, suddenly all concern. "In truth, I am glad for your spinsterhood. I am alone in this world save for my daughters, and it's comforting to know that one of you shall be able to care for me in my older years."
Penelope had a vision of the future, the future as described by her mother, and she had a sudden urge to run out and marry the chimney sweep. She'd long since resigned herself to a life of eternal spinsterhood, but somehow she'd always pictured herself off in her own neat little terrace house, or maybe a snug cottage by the sea. But lately, Portia had been peppering her conversations with references to her old age, and how lucky she was that Penelope could care for her. Never mind that both Prudence and Philippa had married well-heeled men and possessed ample funds to see to their mother's every comfort, or that Portia was moderately wealthy in her own right. When her family had settled money on her as a dowry, 1/4 had been set aside for her own personal account. No, when Portia talked about being cared for, she wasn't referring to money. What Portia wanted was a slave. Penelope sighed. She was being overly harsh with her mother, if only in her own mind. She did that too often. Her mother loved her. She knew her mother loved her, and she loved her mother back. It was just that sometimes she didn't much like her mother. She hoped that didn't make her a bad person, but truly, her mother could try the patience of even the kindest, gentlest of daughters, and as Penelope was the first to admit, she could be a wee bit sarcastic at times.
"Why don't you think Colin would marry Felicity?" Portia asked.
Penelope looked up, startled. She'd thought they were done with that subject. She should have known better. Her mother was nothing if not tenacious.
"Well," she said slowly, "to begin with, she's 12 years younger than he is."
"Pfft,"
Portia said, waving her hand dismissively.
"That's nothing, and you know it."
Penelope frowned, then yelped as she accidentally stabbed her finger with her needle.
"Besides," Portia continued blithely, "he's..."
She looked back down at Whistledown and scanned it for his exact age.
33. How is he meant to avoid a 12-year difference between him and his wife? Surely you don't expect him to marry someone your age."
Penelope sucked on her abused finger, even though she knew it was hopelessly uncouth to do so. But she needed to put something in her mouth to keep her from saying something horrible and horribly spiteful. Everything her mother said was true. Many ton weddings, maybe even most of them, saw men marrying girls a dozen or more years their junior. But somehow the age gap between Colin and Felicity seemed even larger. Perhaps because... Penelope was unable to keep the disgust off her face.
"She's like a sister to him, a little sister."
"Really, Penelope, I hardly think..." "It's almost incestuous,"
Penelope muttered.
"What did you say?"
Penelope snatched up her needlework again.
"Nothing."
"I'm sure you said something."
Penelope shook her head.
"I did clear my throat. Perhaps you heard..."
"I heard you saying something, I'm sure of it."
Penelope groaned. Her life loomed long and tedious ahead of her.
"Mother,"
she said, with the patience of, if not a saint, at least a very devout nun,
"Felicity is practically engaged to Mr. Albansdale."
Portia actually began rubbing her hands together.
"She won't be engaged to him if she can catch Colin Bridgerton."
"Felicity would die before chasing after Colin."
"Of course not. She's a smart girl. Anyone can see that Colin Bridgerton is a better catch."
"But Felicity loves Mr. Albansdale."
Portia deflated into her perfectly upholstered chair.
"There is that. And,"
Penelope added with great feeling,
"Mr. Albansdale is in possession of a perfectly respectable fortune."
Portia tapped her index finger against her cheek.
"True. Not," she said sharply, "as respectable as a Bridgerton portion, but it's nothing to sneeze at, I suppose."
Penelope knew it was time to let it go, but she couldn't stop her mouth from opening one last time.
"In all truth, Mother, he's a wonderful match for Felicity. We should be delighted for her."
I know,"
Portia grumbled.
"It's just that I so wanted one of my daughters to marry a Bridgerton. What a coup! I would be the talk of London for weeks, years, maybe."
Penelope stabbed her needle into the cushion beside her. It was a rather foolish way to vent her anger, but the alternative was to jump to her feet and yell,
"What about me?"
Portia seemed to think that once Felicity was wed, her hopes for a Bridgerton union were forever dashed. But Penelope was still unmarried. Didn't that count for anything? Was it so much to wish that her mother thought of her with the same pride she felt for her other three daughters? Penelope knew that Colin wasn't going to choose her as his bride, but shouldn't a mother be at least a little bit blind to her children's faults? It was obvious to Penelope that neither Prudence, Philippa, nor even Felicity had ever had a chance with a Bridgerton. Why did her mother seem to think their charms so exceeded Penelope's? Very well, Penelope had to admit that Felicity enjoyed a popularity that exceeded that of her three older sisters combined. But Prudence and Philippa had never been incomparables. They'd hovered on the perimeters of ballrooms just as much as Penelope had. Except, of course, that they were married now. Penelope wouldn't have wanted to cleave herself unto either of their husbands, but at least they were wives. Thankfully, however, Portia's mind had already moved on to greener pastures. "I must pay a call upon Violet," she was saying. "She'll be so relieved that Colin is back." "I'm sure Lady Bridgerton will be delighted to see you," Penelope said. "That poor woman," Portia said, her sigh dramatic. "She worries about him, you know."
"I know. Truly, I think it is more than a mother should be expected to bear. He goes gallivanting about, the good Lord only knows where, to countries that are positively unheathen." "I believe they practice Christianity in Greece," Penelope murmured, her eyes back down on her needlework.
"Don't be impertinent, Penelope Ann Featherington. And they're Catholics."
Portia shuddered on the word.
"They're not Catholics at all,"
Penelope replied, giving up on the needlework and setting it aside.
"They're Greek Orthodox."
"Well, they're not Church of England," Portia said with a sniff.
"Seeing as how they're Greek, I don't think they're terribly worried about that."
Portia's eyes narrowed disapprovingly.
"And how do you know about this Greek religion, anyway?" "No, don't tell me," she said with a dramatic flourish. "You read it somewhere."
Penelope just blinked as she tried to think of a suitable reply.
"I wish you wouldn't read so much," Portia sighed. "I probably could have married you off years ago if you had concentrated more on the social graces and less on—"
Penelope had to ask.
"Less on what?"
"I don't know. Whatever it is you do that has you staring into space and daydreaming so often."
"I'm just thinking," Penelope said quietly. "Sometimes I just like to stop and think."
"Stop what?"
Portia wanted to know. Penelope couldn't help but smile. Portia's query seemed to sum up all that was different between mother and daughter.
"It's nothing, mother," Penelope said. "Really."
Portia looked as if she wanted to say more, then thought the better of it. Or maybe she was just hungry. She did pluck a biscuit off the tea tray and pop it into her mouth. Penelope started to reach out to take the last biscuit for herself, then decided to let her mother have it. She might as well keep her mother's mouth full. The last thing she wanted was to find herself in another conversation about Colin Bridgerton.
"Colin's back!"
Penelope looked up from her book, A Brief History of Greece, to see Eloise Bridgerton bursting into her room. As usual, Eloise had not been announced. The Featherington butler was so used to seeing her there that he treated her like a member of the family.
"Is he?" Penelope asked, managing to feign, in her opinion, rather realistic indifference.
Of course, she did set A Brief History of Greece down behind Matilda, the novel by S.R. Fielding that had been all the rage a year earlier. Everyone had a copy of Matilda on their bedstand, and it was thick enough to hide A Brief History of Greece. Eloise sat down in Penelope's desk chair.
"Indeed, and he's very tanned. All that time in the sun, I suppose. He went to Greece, didn't he?"
Eloise shook her head.
"He said the war there has worsened and it was too dangerous. So he went to Cyprus instead."
"My, my,"
Penelope said with a smile.
"Lady Whistledown got something wrong."
Eloise smiled that cheeky Bridgerton smile, and once again Penelope realized how lucky she was to have her as her closest friend. She and Eloise had been inseparable since the age of 17. They'd had their London seasons together, reached adulthood together, and, much to their mother's dismay, had become spinsters together. Eloise claimed that she hadn't met the right person. Penelope, of course, hadn't been asked.
"Did he enjoy Cyprus?"
Penelope inquired. Eloise sighed.
"He said it was brilliant. How I should love to travel. It seems everyone has been somewhere but me."
"And me,"
Penelope reminded her.
"And you,"
Eloise agreed.
"Thank goodness for you."
"Eloise!"
Penelope exclaimed, throwing a pillow at her. But she thanked goodness for Eloise, too, every day. Many women went through their entire lives without a close female friend, and here she had someone to whom she could tell anything. Well, almost anything. Penelope had never told her of her feelings for Colin, although she rather thought Eloise suspected the truth. Eloise was far too tactful to mention it, though, which only validated Penelope's certainty that Colin would never love her. If Eloise had thought, for even one moment, that Penelope actually had a chance at snaring Colin as a husband, she would have been plotting her matchmaking strategies with a ruthlessness that would have impressed any army general. When it came right down to it, Eloise was a rather managing sort of person.
"And then he said that the water was so choppy that he actually cast up his accounts over the side of the boat and..."
Eloise scowled.
"You're not listening to me."
"No," Penelope admitted.
"Well, yes, actually, parts of it. I cannot believe Colin actually told you he vomited." "Well, I am his sister. He'd be furious with you if he knew you told me."
Eloise waved off her protest.
"He won't mind. You're like another sister to him."
Penelope smiled, but she sighed at the same time.
"Mother asked him, of course, whether he was planning to remain in town for the season,"
Eloise continued.
"And, of course, he was terribly evasive. But then I decided to interrogate him myself."
"Terribly smart of you,"
Penelope murmured. Eloise threw the pillow back at her.
"And I finally got him to admit to me that, yes, he thinks he will stay for at least a few months. But he made me promise not to tell Mother."
"Now that's not..."
Penelope cleared her throat.
"Terribly intelligent of him. If your mother thinks his time here is limited, she will redouble her efforts to see him married. I should think that was what he wanted most to avoid."
"It does seem his usual aim in life,"
Eloise concurred.
"If he lulled her into thinking that there was no rush, perhaps she might not badger him quite so much." "An interesting idea,"
Eloise said,
"but probably more true in theory than in practice. My mother is so determined to see him wed that it matters not if she increases her efforts. Her regular efforts are enough to drive him mad as it is."
"Can one go doubly mad?"
Penelope mused. Eloise cocked her head.
"I don't know,"
she said.
"I don't think I should want to find out."
They both fell silent for a moment, a rare occurrence indeed. And then Eloise quite suddenly jumped to her feet and said,
"I must go."
Penelope smiled. People who didn't know Eloise very well thought she had a habit of changing the subject frequently and abruptly. But Penelope knew that the truth was something else altogether. When Eloise had her mind set on something, she was completely unable to let it go. Which meant that if Eloise suddenly wanted to leave, it probably had to do with something they'd been talking about earlier in the afternoon. And,
"Colin is expected for tea,"
Eloise explained. Penelope smiled. She loved being right.
"You should come,"
Eloise said. Penelope shook her head.
"He'll want it to be just family." "You're probably right,"
Eloise said, nodding slightly.
"Very well, then. I must be off. Terribly sorry to cut my visit so short, but I wanted to be sure that you knew Colin was home.
Whistle down,
Penelope reminded her.
Right. Where does that woman get her information?
Eloise said, shaking her head in wonder.
I vow sometimes she knows so much about my family, I wonder if I ought to be frightened.
She can't go on forever,
Penelope commented, getting up to see her friend out.
Someone will eventually figure out who she is, don't you think?
I don't know.
Eloise put her hand on the doorknob, twisted and pulled.
I used to think so, but it's been 10 years. More, actually. If she were going to be caught, I think it would have happened already.
Penelope followed Eloise down the stairs.
Eventually she'll make a mistake. She has to. She's only human.
Eloise laughed.
And here I thought she was a minor god.
Penelope found herself grinning. Eloise stopped and whirled around so suddenly that Penelope crashed right into her, nearly sending both of them tumbling down the last few steps on the staircase.
Do you know what?
Eloise demanded.
I couldn't begin to speculate.
Eloise didn't even bother to pull a face.
I'd wager that she has made a mistake,
she said.
I beg your pardon? You said it yourself. She, or it could be he, I suppose, has been writing the column for over a decade. No one could do that for so long without making a mistake. Do you know what I think?
Penelope just spread her hands in an impatient gesture.
I think the problem is that the rest of us are too stupid to notice her mistakes.
Penelope stared at her for a moment, then burst out laughing.
Oh, Eloise,
she said, wiping tears from her eyes.
I do love you.
Eloise grinned.
And it's a good thing you do, spinster that I am. We shall have to set up a household together when we are 30 and truly crones.
Penelope caught hold of the idea like a lifeboat.
Do you think we could?
She exclaimed. And then, in a hushed voice, after looking furtively up and down the hall,
Mother has begun to speak of her old age with alarming frequency. What's so alarming about that? I mean all of her visions, waiting on her hand and foot. Oh, dear! A milder expletive than had crossed my mind. Penelope!
But Eloise was grinning.
I love my mother,
Penelope said.
I know you do,
Eloise said, in a rather placating sort of voice.
No, I really do.
The left corner of Eloise's mouth began to twitch.
I know you really do. Really.
It's just that...
Eloise put up a hand.
You don't need to say any more. I understand perfectly. Oh! Good day, Mrs. Featherington.
Eloise, Portia said, bustling down the hall. I didn't realise you were here.
I'm sneaky as always,
Eloise said.
Cheeky, even.
Portia gave her an indulgent smile.
I heard your brother is back in town.
Yes, we are all overjoyed.
I'm sure you must be, especially your mother.
Indeed, she is beside herself. I believe she is drawing up a list right now.
Portia's entire aspect perked up, as it did at the mention of anything that might be construed as gossip.
A list? What sort of list?
Oh, you know, the same list she has made for all of her adult children, prospective spouses and all that.
It makes me wonder,
Penelope said in a dry voice,
what constitutes all that? Sometimes she includes one or two people who are hopelessly unsuitable, so as to highlight the qualities of the real possibilities.
Portia laughed.
Perhaps she'll put you on Colin's list, Penelope.
Penelope didn't laugh. Neither did Eloise. Portia didn't seem to notice.
Well, I'd best be off,
Eloise said, clearing her throat to cover a moment that was awkward to two of the three people in the hall.
Colin is expected for tea. Mother wants the entire family in attendance.
Will you all fit?
Penelope asked. Lady Bridgerton's home was large, but the Bridgerton children, spouses and grandchildren numbered 21. It was a large brood indeed.
"We're going to Bridgerton House,"
Eloise explained. Her mother had moved out of the Bridgertons' official London residence after her eldest son had married. Anthony, who had been Viscount since the age of 18, had told Violet that she needn't go, but she had insisted that he and his wife needed their privacy. As a result, Anthony and Kate lived with their three children in Bridgerton House, while Violet lived with her unmarried children, with the exception of Colin, who kept his own lodgings, just a few blocks away at 5 Bruton Street. After a year or so of unsuccessful attempts to name Lady Bridgerton's new home, the family had taken to calling it simply Number 5.
"Do enjoy yourself," Portia said. "I must go and find Felicity. We are late for an appointment at the Moody's."
Eloise watched Portia disappear up the stairs, then said to Penelope,
"Your sister seems to spend a great deal of time at the Modiste."
Penelope shrugged.
"Felicity is going mad with all the fittings, but she's mother's only hope for a truly grand match. I'm afraid she's convinced that Felicity will catch a duke if she's wearing the right gown. Isn't she practically engaged to Mr. Albansdale? I imagine he'll make a formal offer next week, but until then, Mother is keeping her options open."
She rolled her eyes.
"You'd best warn your brother to keep his distance." "Gregory?"
Eloise asked in disbelief.
"He's not even out of university." "Colin." "Colin?"
Eloise exploded with laughter.
"Oh, that's rich." "That's what I told her. But you know how she is once she gets an idea in her head."
Eloise chuckled.
"Rather like me, I imagine. Tenacious to the end." "Tenacity can be a very good thing,"
Eloise reminded her.
"At the proper time."
"Right," Penelope returned with a sarcastic smile.
"And at the improper time, it's an absolute nightmare."
Eloise laughed.
"Cheer up, friend. At least she let you rid yourself of all those yellow frocks."
Penelope looked down at her morning dress, which was, if she did say so herself, a rather flattering shade of blue.
"She stopped choosing my clothing once she finally realised I was officially on the shelf. A girl with no marriage prospects isn't worth the time and energy it takes her to offer fashion advice. She hasn't accompanied me to the Modiste in over a year. Bliss!"
Eloise smiled at her friend, whose complexion turned the loveliest peaches and cream whenever she wore cooler hues.
"It was apparent to all, the moment you were allowed to choose your own clothing. Even Lady Whistledown commented upon it." "I hid that column from Mother,"
Penelope admitted.
"I didn't want her feelings to be hurt."
Eloise blinked a few times before saying,
"That was very kind of you, Penelope. I have my moments of charity and grace." "One would think,"
Eloise said with a snort,
"that a vital component of charity and grace is the ability not to draw attention to one's possession of them."
Penelope pursed her lips as she pushed Eloise toward the door.
"Don't you need to go home? I'm leaving, I'm leaving."
And she left. It was, Colin Bridgerton decided, as he took a sip of some truly excellent brandy, rather nice to be back in England. It was quite strange, actually, how he loved returning home just as much as he did the departure. In another few months, 6 at the most, he'd be itching to leave again. But for now, England in April was positively brilliant. "It's good, isn't it?" Colin looked up. His brother Anthony was leaning against the front of his massive mahogany desk, motioning to him with his own glass of brandy. Colin nodded. "Hadn't realised how much I missed it until I returned. Ouzo has its charms, but this..." He lifted his glass. "Is heaven." Anthony smiled wryly. "And how long do you plan to remain this time?" Colin wandered over to the window and pretended to look out. His eldest brother made little attempt to disguise his impatience with Colin's wanderlust. In truth, Colin really couldn't blame him. Occasionally, it was difficult to get letters home. He supposed that his family often had to wait a month or even two for word of his welfare. But while he knew that he would not relish being in their shoes, never knowing if a loved one was dead or alive, constantly waiting for the knock of the messenger at the front door, that just wasn't enough to keep his feet firmly planted in England. Every now and then, he simply had to get away. There was no other way to describe it. Away from the Ton, who thought him a charming rogue and nothing else. Away from England, which encouraged younger sons to enter the military or the clergy, neither of which suited his temperament. Even away from his family, who loved him unconditionally, but had no clue that what he really wanted, deep down inside, was something to do. His brother Anthony held the viscountcy, and with that came myriad responsibilities. He ran estates, managed the family's finances, and saw to the welfare of countless tenants and servants. Benedict, his elder by 4 years, had gained renown as an artist. He'd started with pencil and paper, but at the urging of his wife had moved on to oils. One of his landscapes now hung in the National Gallery. Anthony would be forever remembered in family trees as the 7th Viscount Bridgerton. Benedict would live through his paintings long after he left this earth. But Colin had nothing. He managed the small property given to him by his family, and he attended parties. He would never dream of claiming he didn't have fun, but sometimes he wanted something a little more than fun. He wanted a purpose. He wanted a legacy. He wanted, if not to know, then at least to hope, that when he was gone, he'd be memorialised in some manner other than in Lady Whistledown's society papers. He sighed. No wonder he spent so much time travelling. "Colin?" his brother prompted. Colin turned to him and blinked. He was fairly certain Anthony had asked him a question, but somewhere, in the meanderings of his mind, he'd forgotten what. "Oh, right." Colin cleared his throat. "I'll be here for the rest of the season, at least." Anthony said nothing, but it was difficult to miss the satisfied expression on his face. "If nothing else," Colin added, affixing his legendary crooked grin on his face, "someone has to spoil your children. I don't think Charlotte has nearly enough dolls." "Only 50, Anthony agreed in a deadpan voice. "The poor girl is horribly neglected. Her birthday is at the end of this month, is it not? I shall have to neglect her some more, I think." "Speaking of birthdays," Anthony said, settling into the large chair behind his desk, "Mother's is a week from Sunday. Why do you think I hurried to return?" Anthony raised a brow, and Colin had the distinct impression that he was trying to decide if Colin had truly rushed home for their mother's birthday, or if he was simply taking advantage of some very good timing. "We're holding a party for her," Anthony said. "She's letting you?" It was Colin's experience that women of a certain age did not enjoy birthday celebrations, and although his mother was still exceedingly lovely, she was definitely of a certain age. "We were forced to resort to blackmail," Anthony admitted. "She agreed to the party, or we revealed her true age." Colin shouldn't have taken a sip of his brandy. He choked on it, and just barely managed to avoid spraying it all over his brother. "I should have liked to have seen that." Anthony offered a rather satisfied smile. "It was a brilliant manoeuvre on my part." Colin finished the rest of his drink. "What, do you think, are the chances she won't use the party as an opportunity to find me a wife?" "Very small." "I thought so." Anthony leaned back in his chair. "You are 33 now, Colin." Colin stared at him in disbelief. "God above, don't you start on me. I wouldn't dream of it. I was merely going to suggest that you keep your eyes open this season.
You needn't actively look for a wife, but there's no harm in remaining at least amenable to the possibility. Colin eyed the doorway, intending to pass through it very shortly. I assure you I am not averse to the idea of marriage. I didn't think you were, Anthony demurred. I see little reason to rush, however. There's never a reason to rush, Anthony returned. Well, rarely, anyway. Just humour, Mother, will you? Colin hadn't realised he was still holding his empty glass until it slipped through his fingers and landed on the carpet with a loud thunk. Good God, he whispered. Is she ill? No, Anthony said, his surprise making his voice loud and forceful. She'll outlive us all, I'm sure of it. Then what is this about? Anthony sighed. I just want to see you happy.
I am happy, Colin insisted.
Are you? Hell, I'm the happiest man in London. Just read Lady Whistledown. She'll tell you so. Anthony glanced down at the paper on his desk. Well, maybe not this column, but anything from last year. I've been called charming more times than Lady Danbury has been called opinionated, and we both know what a feat that is. Charming doesn't necessarily equal happy, Anthony said softly. I don't have time for this, Colin muttered. The door had never looked so good. If you were truly happy, Anthony persisted, you wouldn't keep leaving. Colin paused with his hand on the doorknob. Anthony, I like to travel. Constantly? I must, or I wouldn't do it. That's an evasive sentence if ever I've heard one. And this, Colin flashed his brother a wicked smile, is an evasive manoeuvre. Colin! But he'd already left the room. Chapter 2. It has always been fashionable among the ton to complain of ennui, but surely this year's crop of partygoers has raised boredom to an art form. One cannot take two steps at a society function these days without hearing the phrase dreadfully dull or hopelessly banal. Indeed, this author has even been informed that Cressida Tumbley recently remarked that she was convinced that she might perish of eternal boredom if forced to attend one more off-key musicale. This author must concur with Lady Tumbley on that note. While this year's selection of debutantes are an amiable bunch, there is not a decent musician among them. If there is to be an antidote for the disease of tedium, surely it will be Sunday's fete at Bridgerton House. The entire family will gather, along with 100 or so of their closest friends, to celebrate the Dowager Viscountess's birthday. It is considered crass to mention a lady's age, and so this author will not reveal which birthday Lady Bridgerton is celebrating. But have no fear. This author knows. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 9th of April, 1824. Spinsterhood was a word that tended to invoke either panic or pity. But Penelope was coming to realise that there were decided advantages to the unmarried state. First of all, no one really expected the spinsters to dance at balls, which meant that Penelope was no longer forced to hover at the edge of the dance floor, looking this way and that, pretending that she didn't really want to dance. Now she could sit off to the side with the other spinsters and chaperones. She still wanted to dance, of course. She rather liked dancing, and she was actually quite good at it. Not that anyone ever noticed, but it was much easier to feign disinterest the farther one got from the waltzing couples. Second, the number of hours spent in dull conversation had been drastically reduced. Mrs. Featherington had officially given up hope that Penelope might ever snag a husband, and so she'd stopped thrusting her in the path of every third-tier eligible bachelor. Portia had never really thought Penelope had a prayer of attracting the attention of a first- or second-tier bachelor, which was probably true,
but most of the third-tier bachelors were classified as such for a reason, and sadly that reason was often personality, or lack thereof, which, when combined with Penelope's shyness with strangers, didn't tend to promote sparkling conversation. And finally, she could eat again. It was maddening, considering the amount of food generally on display at ton parties, but women on the hunt for husbands weren't supposed to exhibit anything more robust than a bird's appetite. This, Penelope thought gleefully, as she bit into what had to be the most heavenly eclair outside of France, had to be the best spinster perk of all.
"Good heavens!"
she moaned. If sin could take a solid form, surely it would be a pastry, preferably one with chocolate.
"That good, eh?"
Penelope choked on the eclair, then coughed, sending a fine spray of pastry cream through the air.
"Colin!"
she gasped, fervently praying the largest of the globs had missed his ear.
"Penelope!"
he smiled warmly.
"It's good to see you."
"And you."
He rocked on his heels, once, twice, thrice, then said,
"You look well."
"And you,"
she said, too preoccupied with trying to figure out where to set down her eclair to offer much variety to her conversation.
"That's a nice dress,"
he said, motioning to her green silk gown. She smiled ruefully, explaining,
"It's not yellow."
"So it's not."
He grinned, and the ice was broken. It was strange, because one would think her tongue would be tied the tightest around the man she loved, but there was something about Colin that set everyone at ease. Maybe, Penelope had thought on more than one occasion, part of the reason she loved him was that he made her feel comfortable with herself.
"Eloise tells me you had a splendid time in Cyprus,"
she said. He grinned.
"Couldn't resist the birthplace of Aphrodite, after all."
Penelope found herself smiling as well. His good humour was infectious, even if the last thing she wanted to do was take part in a discussion of the goddess of love.
"Was it as sunny as everyone says?"
she asked.
"No, forget I asked. I can see from your face that it was."
"I did acquire a bit of a tan,"
he said with a nod.
"My mother nearly fainted when she saw me."
"From delight, I'm sure,"
Penelope said emphatically.
"She misses you terribly when you're gone."
He leaned in.
"Come now, Penelope. Surely you're not going to start in on me. Between my mother, Antony, Eloise and Daphne, I'm liable to perish of guilt."
"Not Benedict,"
she couldn't help quipping. He shot her a slightly smirky look.
"He's out of town."
"Ah, well, that explains his silence."
His narrowed eyes matched his crossed arms to perfection.
"You've always been cheeky. Did you know that?"
"I hide it well,"
she said modestly.
"It's easy to see," he said in a dry voice, "why you are such good friends with my sister."
"I'm assuming you intended that as a compliment."
"I'm fairly certain I'd be endangering my health if I'd intended it any other way."
Penelope was standing there, hoping she'd think of a witty rejoinder, when she heard a strange, wet, splattish sound. She looked down to discover that a large, yellowish blob of pastry cream had slid from her half-eaten eclair and landed on the pristine wooden floor. She looked back up to find Colin's oh-so-green eyes dancing with laughter, even as his mouth fought for a serious expression.
"Well, now, that's embarrassing,"
Penelope said, deciding that the only way to avoid dying of mortification was to state the painfully obvious.
"I suggest,"
Colin said, raising one brow into a perfectly debonair arch, "that we flee the scene." Penelope looked down at the empty carcass of the eclair still in her hand. Colin answered her with a nod toward a nearby potted plant.
"No,"
she said, her eyes growing wide. He leaned in closer.
"I dare you."
Her eyes darted from the eclair to the plant and back to Colin's face.
"I couldn't,"
she said. "As far as naughty things go, this one is fairly mild," he pointed out. It was a dare, and Penelope was usually immune to such childish ploys, but Colin's half-smile was difficult to resist.
"Very well,"
she said, squaring her shoulders and dropping the pastry onto the soil. She took a step back, examined her handiwork, looked around to see if anyone besides Colin was watching her, then leaned down and rotated the pot so that a leafy branch covered the evidence. "I didn't think you'd do it," Colin said.
"As you said, it's not terribly naughty."
"No, but it is my mother's favourite potted palm."
"Colin!"
Penelope whirled around, fully intending to sink her hand right back into the plant to retrieve the eclair.
"How could you let me? Wait a second."
She straightened. Her eyes narrowed.
"This isn't a palm."
He was all innocence.
"It's not."
"It's a miniature orange tree."
He blinked.
"Is it now?"
She scowled at him. Or at least she hoped it was a scowl. It was difficult to scowl at Colin Bridgerton. Even his mother had once remarked that it was nearly impossible to reprimand him. He would just smile and look contrite and say something funny, and you just couldn't stay angry with him. You simply couldn't do it.
"You were trying to make me feel guilty," Penelope said.
"Anyone could confuse a palm with an orange tree."
She fought the urge to roll her eyes.
"Except for the oranges."
He chewed on his lower lip, his eyes thoughtful.
"Yes. One would think they'd be a bit of a giveaway."
"You're a terrible liar. Did you know that?"
He straightened, tugging slightly at his waistcoat as he lifted his chin.
"Actually, I'm an excellent liar. But what I'm really good at is appearing appropriately sheepish and adorable after I'm caught."
What, Penelope wondered, was she meant to say to that? Because surely there was no one more adorably sheepish... sheepishly adorable? Than Colin Bridgerton, with his hands clasped behind his back, his eyes flitting along the ceiling, and his lips puckered into an innocent whistle.
"When you were a child," Penelope asked, abruptly changing the subject, "were you ever punished?"
Colin immediately straightened to attention.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Were you ever punished as a child?"
she repeated.
"Are you ever punished now?"
Colin just stared at her, wondering if she had any idea what she was asking. Probably not.
He
said, mostly because he hadn't anything else to say. She let out a vaguely patronising sigh.
"I thought not."
If he were a less indulgent man, and if this were anyone but Penelope Featherington, whom he knew did not possess a malicious bone in her body, he might take offence. But he was an uncommonly easy-going fellow, and this was Penelope Featherington, who had been a faithful friend to his sister for God knows how many years. So instead of adopting a hard, cynical stare, which admittedly was an expression at which he'd never excelled, he merely smiled and murmured,
"Your point being?"
"Do not think I mean to criticise your parents," she said, with an expression that was innocent and sly at the same time. "I would never dream of implying that he was spoiled in any way."
He nodded graciously.
"It's just that..."
She leaned in, as if imparting a grave secret.
"I rather think you could get away with murder if you so chose."
He coughed, not to clear his throat, and not because he wasn't feeling well, but rather because he was so damned startled. Penelope was such a funny character. No, that wasn't quite right. She was surprising. Yes, that seemed to sum her up. Very few people really knew her. She had certainly never developed a reputation as a sterling conversationalist. He was fairly certain she'd made it through three-hour parties without ever venturing beyond words of a single syllable. But when Penelope was in the company of someone with whom she felt comfortable,
and Colin realized that he was probably privileged to count himself among that number. She had a dry wit, a sly smile, and evidence of a